We cooked from scratch, and even though it was only baked chicken and buttered noodles and spaghetti and meatballs, we made it all ourselves. I worried that I wouldn't have enough peanut butter or breakfast cereal, and that I was 30 miles from the nearest town with only a once-a-week appearance of that giant 18-wheeler that Cisco would send up from Boston on Wednesdays. Bearing everything I needed for the kitchen, except vegetables, that gleaming monster of a truck would slowly make its way down the winding and meandering gravel road, the driver in a blue uniform with a name patch sewed on his breast pocket, and a blue Cisco trucker's hat, taking his time. This would not be a good place for an 18-wheeler to get stuck in a ditch. The counselor girls in their pajama bottoms and the counselor guys in their Greenpeace t-shirts paused their hacky sack games and made a human chain from the back of the truck to the kitchen, where they good-naturedly hauled in the huge weekly order and stacked it. The produce came from a local organic operation out of Amherst. Their truck was a battered mustard-yellow panel truck with a big butternut squash logo on the sides, and the drivers were all good-looking and polite and incredibly friendly guys in dungarees who had quite possibly just graduated, not in traditional cap and gown, but in Birkenstocks with a bell-ringing ritual, from my alma mater, Hampshire College. Kids don't eat vegetables, but I bought them the best anyway. I had accepted the logistical fate of ordering meat and dairy and dry goods from Cisco when I understood that being on 100 wooded acres out in the pine forests of western Massachusetts took me off the delivery routes of better purveyors, but I couldn't bring myself to buy vegetables from them, too. Many of these kids had suspicious food allergies that I had to carefully work around. At the beginning of every session, I passed around a survey to all the bunks, birch through willow, boys and girls, and asked each child to alert us to any special dietary needs, any allergies or diabetes or issues around food. Every year, for the 4 years that I was the chef at this camp, there would be one boy with a very serious peanut allergy who really would swell up and die if I carelessly used the same spoon at the make-your-own Sunday bar for Jimmy's as I had used for peanuts. While every session I had no fewer than 16 girls with allergies to dairy and wheat, cheese and bread basically, but also to garlic, eggplant, corn, and nuts. They had cleverly developed allergies, I believe, to the foods they had seen their own mothers fearing and loathing as diet fads passed through their homes. I could have strangled their mothers for saddling these girls with the idea that food is an enemy. Some of them only 8 years old and already weird about wanting a piece of bread. And I would have liked to bludgeon them, too, for forcing me to participate in their young daughter's fucked-up relationship with food. I was obliged to attend to the allergies. For the first time in probably the entire decade that had passed since I had seen or spoken to my own mother, I thought warm and grateful thoughts about her. She instilled in us nothing but a total and unconditional pleasure in food and eating. There were a couple of girls at this camp, however, who were quite different. And many nights during dinner, these sisters would come up to the huge open kitchen window, the pass-through, where we, the kitchen crew, served out platter after unbreakable melamine platter of pale, bland, innocuous, and inoffensive foods to the kids assigned as that night's table waiters, and then stood there waiting to refill their family-style platters with seconds. These girls would come up to the window and ask politely for the balsamic vinegar, please. Oh, little Emma, with her chubby cheeks and some braided thing around her wrist that she had made that afternoon in the crafts barn, I could have kissed her every evening for appreciating the food and even daring me to make it a little more adult at every meal. Those kinds of kids can be obnoxious too, I admit, with their over-sophisticated tastes, turning up their noses at good old fried chicken, claiming to prefer a paillard quickly sautéed, and insisting on extra virgin olive oil. That kind of cultivated taste could be sort of unbearable in an 8-year-old, but not this girl. She was pleased to please me, almost aware of how charming she was in her little way, asking for Parmesan cheese or fresh black pepper. But most of the 100 or so kids ate like pigs, and just as fast and just as loud, and made big, gruesome messes of their meals by pouring milk into their food and stirring it around, giggling uncontrollably, while their counselor pretended to keep some order at the table. 3 weeks into it, just when I thought I would die from tater tots and baked chicken, we had session change, and all the parents came up to camp for parents' visiting day. At last, I could really roll out a spread, a spicy, slimy, wiggly, bitter green and bony spread. I couldn't spend any real money, it wasn't in the budget, but I could cook anything I wanted. We were giddy, Sean and I, to have our hands in stinky Vietnamese fish sauce for the vegetarian spring rolls, which we packed with cilantro and jicama and carrots and cucumbers. The four kitchen helpers were maybe not so enthused to be pulling the beards out of and scrubbing 20 pounds of mussels for the chilled mussels on the half shell with vinaigrette, but if working in a kitchen was something they had all wanted to check out, this was a perfect introduction. As best as we could, using the butter-yellow melamine plates, we artfully arranged soppressata, Alphonse olives, hard cheeses, and bread that had crust and body that could actually hurt the roof of your mouth if you were unaccustomed. We fried fatty, bony duck wings and coated them in toasted sesame seeds. We untangled mounds of curly bitter endive and tamed it with pear and walnuts and vinegar with bacon fat. It was a perfect New England summer day, hot and breezy, and a saturated blue sky made more beautiful by puffy white clouds. Parents in clogs and tivas, having almost all arrived from Brooklyn in Volvo station wagons, were swarming the campus, moving from bunk to arts barn to theater to see all of the clever and crafty things their kids had been doing for the past 3 weeks. I was transferring a whole side of cold poached sea bass from a sheet pan onto a serving platter, the fish a little longer than our largest platter, unfortunately, and getting ready to dress it with some parsley oil, when I noticed one of these parents standing at the pass-through, watching me with amused curiosity. "Hello there," I said. "Are you responsible for all this?" he asked, pointing back to the buffet. "I guess so, yes." "I'm Emma's dad. She's been telling me about you all summer." "Emma's dad," I cried, lighting up. "I love Emma." I put down my spoon and went to the pass to shake hands. "I'm Gabrielle." He said so many kind things about the food, and I felt so rewarded, but I noticed that he spoke about the food the way that only someone who works with food could. There is a way, a distinct way, that people who work in the industry speak to each other about food, and you can tell within minutes that they are part of your extended clan. It's not like an obnoxious foodie talks about food, ostentatiously throwing around kitchen terms and names of ingredients they have researched at length. It's not like an appreciative eater talks about food, awed and enamored and perfectly happy to speak of his enjoyment without having any idea of what he's just eaten or how it was achieved. It's the way only someone who works in the industry talks about food, by almost not talking about it, but just throwing out a few code words and signals, like a gang member flashing you his sign. Every single time that I sit at a restaurant's bar, order the Chocoli or Gruner Veltliner rather than the Sauvignon Blanc, ask for the razor clams and not the calamari, I am sniffed out immediately by the server as an industry peer, having said nothing. "Who are you?" I finally asked, having picked up every single one of his gang signs. "I'm Mark, Mark Bittman." The father of Emma turned out to be Mark Bittman, the cookbook writer and New York Times columnist. Of course she loved balsamic vinegar and Parmesan cheese and fresh ground black pepper. At the end of every summer, I was asked to prepare a lavish and special dinner for the staff. The tradition was to have lobster, that creature that most signals luxury and splurge. After the last weeping, deeply tanned kid had pulled out of camp with his popsicle stick cabin and tie-dyed t-shirts in the trunk of his parents' car, waving out the dusty back window to all of his beloved counselors the entire length of the gravel road until he was out of sight, we were all left alone on the beautiful campus. We had to clean up and close down. Between this very minute and sundown the next night, the canoes needed to be hung in the shed and all the life vests washed and sun-dried and then wrapped in heavy black garbage bags. The glue and glitter and pipe cleaners in the art barn had to be neatly arranged in their tight-lidded 2-pound coffee cans. The mattresses and springed cots needed to be stacked in the barn attic. And when that was done, everyone could come down to the fire pit for an outdoor feast in appreciation of their hard work dispensed all summer long. Each year, I butterflied and grilled whole Maine lobsters over real wood charcoals and basted them with smoked paprika butter. I grilled leeks and red onion and corn on the cob in the husk after soaking it in one of the horse's water tubs filled from the garden hose. We had sliced tomatoes and cherries and watermelon, and in this instance, with the kids gone, we drank a lot of cold beer. In Northampton, a 25-minute drive south on a quiet set of roads, there was a good seafood guy. I got my lobsters from him every year. It was a fun excursion and a total change of pace and scenery to head into town with its foreign film houses and organic coffee roasters and summer session Smith College girls riding their bicycles around. I resurrected a routine I had established when I was in college nearby and working at Jake's, of stopping at Steve's ice cream for a scoop of malted date and a scoop of sweet cream ice cream, two flavors like your birthday and Christmas morning rolled together, and then proceeded on to the seafood wholesaler to pick up my 30 clawed beasts, neatly packed and sound asleep in chilled styrofoam coffins, as they're called. I'd return to camp in the late afternoon, put the styrofoam boxes of live 2-pound lobsters right into the walk-in, then grill them the following evening down at the fire pit. My last year as camp cook, I decided to skip my normal routine, and instead of going into town myself, I passed the errand off to the whole gang of counselors who were taking the van into town to bum around and do laundry and drink beer. I was really looking forward to a quiet, vacated campus. The impending return to my cramped New York City apartment and that grisly catering workload was weighing on me differently than years past, and I wanted to stay on campus as many of these last hours as I could. I asked Laurel, one of the long-haired, pajama-pants hippie girls who was assigned to drive the van, if she could go to the wholesaler and pick up my lobsters, which I'd already ordered. "Sure, man," she said, ignoring my gender. "But, like, we're probably going to get back kind of late, you know," she giggled. I understood this to mean that they were going to hit a bar for a while before returning to camp. "No problem," I said. "Just throw the boxes into the walk-in when you get back if I'm not still up. That's all you have to do." "Okay, cool," she agreed. And soon, the campus was nearly empty. Even Sean, a teetotaler, had joined the group just to get away from the insect-ridden wilderness that he'd been enduring for 6 weeks. I spent the whole day in silence, cleaning and wrapping up the kitchen. Debbie and the kitchen crew had done a major job in washing all of the plates and cups and cutlery and putting it all away in the attic. And they'd taken a vanload of surplus dry goods over to the school, where it would be put to good use in the coming weeks. I was left to clean the stoves and scour the walk-in and unplug the phone and de-lime the dishwasher, tasks I love, as they keep your hands occupied and your mind free to wander. I watched the horse ladies back up their trailer to the paddock and load the horses into it and then drive away, slowly making their way up the long drive. Suzette, the maintenance gal who walked around all summer with her tool belt on, nailed closed the barn shutters and padlocked every outbuilding on camp, finally hanging all the keys in their labeled spots in the office, and went home. I left myself a couple of cutting boards and the few things I would need to produce the meal the following afternoon, but since I would be grilling almost all of the food down at the fire pit, I had the rest of the kitchen pretty nicely put down. I emptied all the salt shakers and the soap dispensers and scrubbed out the milk cow with bleach. At dusk, a bluer and earlier setting dusk, I noticed, this late in August than it had been in June when we arrived, I made a small meal out of a few leftovers in the fridge and headed for the screen door to sit on the back stoop. Something made me stop short and hang in mid-stride. At first, I smelled an incredibly pungent kind of ammonia as I froze my hand on the door just about to push it open. I could hear someone breathing, heavily and irregularly. I stood dead still. And then a full-grown black bear ambled by, not 10 feet away, with nothing but screen door between him and me and my bowl of dinner. He continued on his way down past the barn and across the field and disappeared into the woods, just as it was getting too dark to easily make out his shape in the distance. I opened the door, sat down on the stoop, and ate my dinner. The kids were not back from town, so I turned out the light and went up to my cottage, loudly clapping my hands the whole way in the dark to scare off any other thing that might appear. At around midnight, I heard the van creeping down the long road to camp, its headlights and taillights the only illuminated things in an otherwise pitch-black night. Silence everywhere except for their drunken laughter and the car radio blowing out the windows. I heard them park and kill the ignition. And then I heard the slam of the screen door to the kitchen as it echoed up the hill to my cottage. Feeling secure that they had just deposited the lobsters in the walk-in, I turned out my light and went to sleep. I was always the first one up at camp. I had to get to the kitchen by 6 to make sure waffles were made and coffee brewed and the canoe trips packed out with their crates of food. The director rang the camp bell at 7:30, and each morning there was a camp-wide assembly outside the dining hall before they would all pile in for breakfast. I did this every morning, first one in, to be quite ready. So even on the last day, with the kids gone and nothing but our end-of-year counselor appreciation dinner to pull off, By habit, I still was up and heading down through the wet grass in my tall rubber boots at around 6 the following morning. I pulled open the screen door, ducked under the pass-through to enter the kitchen, and nearly crushed a lobster lying right there at my feet. I couldn't comprehend what I was seeing. What was a dead lobster doing on the floor at the entrance to the kitchen? Had it fallen, unnoticed, out of one of the coffins when the kids were putting them away last night? How drunk could they have been not to notice? I followed my eyes across the kitchen floor, and I'm not sure if I moaned out loud or physically gasped out loud. In the middle of the kitchen floor, I saw another lobster, dead, and just next to it, another, and then, a couple of feet behind him, two more. I was losing my breath. I looked up and there, clinging onto the edge of the three-bin pot sink, but having expired mid-journey, another lobster. With a clenching knot in my stomach and welling up with tears, I cautiously made my way to the sink and there found the rest of the 30 lobsters drowned in cool tap water. The ones on the floor had crawled up on the backs of the others, scrambling for freedom, for oxygen, and had clawed their way out of the sink and onto the floor before dying midway across the wooden planks. I was sick, and I could barely breathe. And even when I pushed myself outside into the fresh air and the rising sunshine and the wet dew, I couldn't feel cleansed or well or recovered from the stupid death I had just picked my way through. I felt as if I had been poisoned. They were just lobsters, but it takes a lobster more than 15 years to grow to 3 pounds. Grown men die harvesting them. The boat moves along as the lobstermen stand in back hauling up the pots and dumping the lobsters on deck. You can get your leg caught in a line and go overboard. It happens. And 45 pounds of massacre of anything is hard to stomach. Giant stupid sea bugs, even. Lobsters live in deep, cold ocean water. Ocean water, as most of us know, is salty and not the stuff that runs out of the tap of a camp kitchen sink. But how could this have happened? Sean would have surely known exactly what to do with the lobsters. I had given Hippie Chick clear instructions. I went back into the kitchen and started to collect them all and place them back into the styrofoam containers they had arrived in, which were sitting open on the counter. I scanned my memory for the events of the night before. Hadn't I heard the screen door slam? Didn't that mean they had entered the kitchen? But I had clicked off my light and gone to sleep before I heard the screen door slam again, signaling that they had left the kitchen. I drained the water from the sink and put the rest of the lobsters into the coffins. The irony of the word we use to describe these rectangular containers for keeping fish fresh, not lost on me. And Sean appeared, but I couldn't even talk. He was also stunned. "Gab," he said quietly. "We put them in the walk-in and I went to bed. I don't know what happened here." But by now, of course, I did. I could imagine the whole thing. A van full of blotto, stoned kids returned to camp and stayed up all night drinking and smoking and hugging long, meaningful hugs with their camp soulmates, whom they might not be seeing again for a whole year. In between bong hits, one of them, maybe the guy with the hacky sack, says, "Dude, like, how cool are these crazy lobsters?" Somebody coughs and exhales smoke at the same time. "But aren't they, like, gonna die without any water?" wonders aloud the guy in the Greenpeace t-shirt. Oh, man, dude. You're totally right. But Laurel, shaking her waist-long curly hair, says, "Gabrielle said just to, like, put them in the walk-in." Choke, cough, exhale. "This is some harsh bud, dude. We should put them in some water, I think. Definitely. Yeah. Def." So instead of leaving the perfectly packed, sleeping, vital lobsters in the walk-in as I'd asked them, they started to worry. And worry, wrapped up in the gauze of a marijuana high, turned into crystal-clear paranoia about animal cruelty. And just behind that paranoia came soft, waxy thoughts about animal rescue that drove them to fill the kitchen sinks with cold water, pull the styrofoam boxes out of the walk-in, drop each sleeping lobster into the makeshift tank, and inadvertently suffocate all of them to death. Proud and relieved, they snapped off the kitchen lights and went and passed out in their stinking bunks, while the lobsters, panicking, now thrashed and clawed up and over each other to get out of their death pool. After burying the 30 dead lobsters in a little grave I dug between the arts barn and the soccer field, I shut down the kitchen for the season and let the screen door slam behind me. I drove north to Pittsfield and I bought 10 boxes of Kentucky Fried Chicken, left it at the fire pit, and then I drove off campus for good. Heading down 91, making my way back to the city, to the West Side warehouse kitchens, to what I was starting to think would be another 20 years of everyday life, I hoped the bear would find the KFC and the counselors and eat them both. Chapter 7. I had, without ever deciding or desiring to, racked up nearly 20 years of kitchen work, if we start with my dishwashing stint at the Canal House that adolescent summer. And now I was good at it. In college, I had met the Southern writer Jo Carson, and she said, "Be careful what you get good at doing, because you'll be doing it for the rest of your life." And that had forever stuck with me. I thought it would be useful, as my 30th birthday neared, to discover if I had any talent other than churning out the 20-hour shifts without complaint, smoking filterless cigarettes, and out-cussing my male colleagues. I had always imagined I would end up as a writer, but I'd never made the time for it or discovered a way, sapped and depleted after those long shifts, to dedicate myself to it. All I had were boxes and boxes of notebooks accumulated over the years, grown-up versions of that silly, cherished red leather lock-and-key diary I'd kept as a kid. The pages filled with, well, nothing remotely disciplined. For the genuine effort of real writing, I was never able to find the time. Yet I was the girl who put on her coat over her chef's whites and spent an extra hour cleaning out the cruddy walk-in refrigerator. Aside from an ironclad work ethic born of an early understanding of self-reliance, I was wondering if I had anything else to offer. I was wondering if there was still time for a life of my own choosing. What had started as a quick and urgent necessity, that nearly empty shampoo bottle and even emptier house driving me into town to look for a job, had become a lifetime, a lifestyle, and a life lived gazing over at the greener pasture. I had wanted to do so much more, somehow, than spend my days with my hands thrust into a bowl of microgreens, lightly dressed with aged balsamic and garnished with toasted pumpkin seeds and roasted apricots. I had always wanted to contribute in some way, leave a little more than I took. The ironic and disaffected stance toward life had not yet closed its full, suffocating grip on the throat of the world, and at the time, I remember, it did not feel embarrassing or over-earnest to say that you hoped to make a difference. It did not feel hopeless or even futile to declare your deep and total admiration for the million-man marchers with their sons and fathers walking together, or the radical ACT-UP kids who were lying their own fragile bodies down on the freezing pavement of Times Square at rush hour, stopping traffic with their die-ins, or the brilliant visionaries who were unfurling that ever-expanding quilted acre of bottomless sorrow and getting arrested for trespassing on Bush's White House lawn in the doing. My heart caved in a little further every month when the popular food magazines hit the stands and in them were articles entitled, "What to Wear to Your Favorite Expensive Restaurant," or "Chef's Favorite Kitchen Tools," or this urgent topic, "French Chef Doesn't Use Butter at Home." This may sound like badly written parody, but I am quoting actual food magazines. It's hard to work in an industry where these are the headlines. Or at least I was finding it kind of demoralizing to feel like my most significant contribution to the world each day was that I made enough baby artichoke ragu for that night's wedding rehearsal dinner. People who were thinking of ways to guide me when I would describe to them my jam, "I'm not interested in my industry, but I'm locked into my industry. I don't know how to do anything else," tried to talk me out of my pessimistic and cynical place by pointing out how important food is in our lives, how important it is to sit around the dinner table with friends and family. I argued back that people who sat around dinner tables these days were discussing nothing more than the food that was placed in front of them, and marveling at its spiral of pin dots of pistachio oil administered with a squeeze bottle around the rim of a 14-inch plate. When I described what I felt was so achingly missing from my line of work, namely meaning and purpose, they would encourage me to go cook in a soup kitchen or a hospice, or to get a job cooking for an agency that delivered meals to the homebound elderly. But there was not one molecule in my body that was engineered to ladle out low-sodium, low-fat, compartmentalized meals designed and overseen by a nutritionist and an officer from the Department of Health and Human Services. I felt less than useful doing it, but nonetheless, I loved the baby artichokes and the vivid green pistachio oil I was handling. Large-scale, high-end cooking, with all of its imperfections and corner-cutting, at least put me in contact with ceviche and Israeli couscous and mushroom duxelles and robiola cheese, and was still preferable to just plain institutional cooking in a hairnet and latex gloves, no matter how empty of meaning and purpose. But what began as a nagging discontent in that green forest of western Massachusetts had become a dark preoccupation back in New York City, and finally turned into a full-blown crisis as I was wheeling a proofing cabinet of 200 boxed lunches, goat cheese and arugula pesto roll-ups, up the service entrance ramp to the building where, if I recall correctly, the National Book Foundation's fall conference was taking place. Trying to quietly roll this metal cabinet filled to the top with the neatly packaged sandwiches and cookies, I squeaked down the hallway just outside the auditorium toward the lobby, where I was instructed to set out the self-serve lunches and then depart. The auditorium doors kept opening and closing as attendees came and went, and every time they opened, the voices of the panelists and their gorgeous words, Grace Paley, Galway Canal, Jamaica Kincaid, I thought I recognized so many of them but couldn't be certain, floated out into the hallway. It felt almost cruel to be schlepping this metal box on wheels down the corridor in my chef whites and black clogs, while inside that auditorium was a room full of people I wanted to be. A room full of people who did just the kind of work I wished I could do. For the first time in my 20 years in a kitchen, I felt a real sting to be feeding and not mingling with the room full of people. Dave, the driver, was waiting in the idling van with the radio fixed to Hot 97 and blasting so loud that the windows vibrated. I banged on the side of the van, and he popped out and helped me load the empty proofing cabinet into the back. Shaggy blasted out of the cargo van speakers, over which Dave yelled, "Back to the shop?" "I'm done, Dave. This lunch gig was my only booking for the day. Can you clock me out when you go back? I'm done." I had no ties to anyone or anything. Out of sight, out of mind. So I was not conflicted in elapsed time sequence to clock out on my last freelancer shift at one of those warehouse kitchens, sublet the East Village tenement one bedroom, kiss the girlfriend goodbye, pack the matte black Volvo, and head out to grad school. I had applied for a spot at Iowa, which everyone I asked advised me was the best and most famous writer's program in the country, but instead had gotten a spot at the University of Michigan in the master's program for fiction writing. That September, I rolled into Ann Arbor to start a whole new, clean, and kitchen-free life. The very first thing I did when I got there was land a kitchen job. Because I can't sleep at night, let alone aspire to write National Book Award-worthy prose, if I don't have a job. Misty, when I met her, was grilling boneless chicken breasts for U of M tailgate parties, wearing a stained, faded V-neck t-shirt and a dirty apron. I didn't see anything in her but the tired, slightly beaten chef of a perfectly decent catering company in downtown Ann Arbor. While I had a 10-pound knife kit brimming with tweezers and Q-tips, fish spatulas and needle-nose pliers, she was assembling rigid, odorless cheese platters for university functions. I had cooked for the King of Thailand. She was, I thought, simply the source of my future paychecks and nothing more. The next day I went to register for school, and when I walked on Michigan's campus for the first time, strolling the Diag with its pristine landscaping and swiping my student ID at the library, which looked like one of those buildings in Thomas Jefferson's America, I was ebullient. I had not visited any campus during the application process. I had just cast my net and hauled in the best offer, and then followed it to Michigan, for whatever awaited me. When I saw the 100-year-old columns of Angel Hall, I skipped up all 25 of its granite stairs. I sat in every single leather chair on all four floors of the Rackham Graduate School. I stared at all the oil portraits. If I entered a room with a Persian carpet, I took off my shoes and socks and walked barefoot on it. If there were cheese cubes in the writer's room, I ate them with delight. Alternative high school and alternative college, housed in old barns or in prefab modular units of click-together plywood, were a necessary and important part of my development, but had trashed my own sense of validity. But this highly polished marble floor, this leather chair, these brass banisters, these chandeliers, this was total legitimacy. Everybody I met referred to the school as the Harvard of the Midwest, and it took me only 2.5 minutes to follow suit. Check me out! A dishwasher matriculated at the Harvard of the Midwest entered through the front door by invitation, and I picked up my first fellowship check, $1,000, and walked around like someone whose lottery ticket is called on the evening news. I could not get over my luck. They were paying me to read and write. I got $1,000 a month just to sit around the grad writing room eating cheese and discussing metaphor, to gaze out from a big leather chair thinking, to read as many books as they assigned, and to teach freshmen how to write a tight 5-paragraph college essay. An academic workday was only 6 hours long. As if that weren't lavish enough, for a certain stretch of my commute to and from school each day, the speed limit on the Michigan highway, unlike anywhere else in the United States that I had lived, was 75 miles an hour. There were a few signs of weirdness, but I shrugged them off. My fellow program mates seemed unaccountably anguished when I met them at our first orientation. Also, this was my first time in a university football town. I thought it was bizarre that grown men wore maize and blue parkas, hats, and golf socks, often all at once. I had never seen this before, and it spooked me, the way that seeing too many civilian children in scout uniforms also made me nervous. Misty sent me out to chef a few parties in my first weeks there, and when the guests asked me where I was from or how I had come to Michigan or when I had gotten my tongue pierced, they smiled emptily and said, "Oh, that's nice," without meaning it, and the conversation stopped before they even started. But there's weirdness in New York, too, so I shook it off. My route to rehabilitation, starting anew, not as a dishwasher but as a writer, seemed to be a straight shot. Except that I had never heard of the second-person static point of view and had completely forgotten the meaning of indirect interior discourse. My sullen new friends had read so many books that I hadn't and had already, by 23 years old, become fluent with so many terms, ideas, and words that I had never heard of. And they could put sentences together in class using so many of them that I was sure, if I tried to contribute to the discussion, it would be instantly discovered that I had been accepted by accident, that someone had messed up and put my application in the wrong pile. In the world I had occupied before coming to this campus, I was the one with the words. In those kitchens filled with transient part-timers, it was an obvious testament to my potential for high intelligence that I completed the crossword puzzle each day of the week, including Sunday, in pen, and that I could remember and recite a few stanzas of Chaucer. In this new world, where 23-year-olds discussed Bartesian tropes and post-Hegelian moments with the same ease with which I boiled water for pasta, I smarted with the realization of my own amateurism. While I had taken the part-time catering job with Misty just to pay my rent, I noticed as the semester progressed that I started to depend on it as a buffer from the sting I often felt on campus during class discussions of narrative strategy and diction. These people were not fucking around. It was like a salve to have a few hours each day where I understood the terms like sauté and roast and sweat to translucent, and to hang out with 35-year-old cooks who hustled past with sheet pans hot out of the oven yelling, "Hot behind," as we all sniggered cheerfully at the sexual connotation. There was no sexual connotation among academics, and when I, out of habit, tried to throw some around, it just fell on the marble floor, untouched. I was having a hard time embracing my new tribe on campus. They kindly pretended to admire my experiences with hot ovens and lobsters, and they overgenerously allowed me to get around whatever intellectual blocks I faced. I will never confidently understand a post-Hegelian moment. By allowing me to dismiss it as elitist and esoteric, they even paused to agree with me and then went right back to their work. But there remained, and I was somehow committed to, a cleavage between me and them. I was friendly with a fiction writer named Elwood, who had hunted, fished, bartended, and played U of M football, not as a walk-on but as a recruit, and I think once had stapled dollar bills to his own bare chest at a frat party. And I was getting to know Jeff, a poet who played in a band and drank all the amber liquors without getting sloppy, when most of the guys in the program called it quits after 2 beers. He also, to my eternal gratitude, unequivocally confirmed what I had always intuited about sex scenes in novels written by older men. "Yeah, that stuff is creepy," Jeff said. "It's just plain wrong." Whenever our director, a famous-ish and prolific writer, would publish a new book, like every 3 months it seemed, Jeff would roll his eyes and smile during wine and cheese hour and point to the page where, in all 23 novels, our blue blazer director would write a sex scene and describe the woman's nipple. I was also relieved to meet Kate, who had as much frustration with grading the freshman papers as I did. The freshmen were poorer writers than I remember being when I was a freshman, and yet expected much higher grades than they had earned. but maybe all people feel like the generations after them are depraved. Kate, who was also teaching intro to comp sections, held office hours across from me in the afternoons. We kept our doors open when waiting for students and chatted in between appointments. But these new acquaintances were a year ahead of me or busy otherwise, and I didn't see them as much as I needed to. Meanwhile, Misty and I were working away together under the fluorescent lights, with cold smoked chicken in apricot glaze and sirloin tips in molasses black pepper sauce. The Midwestern requirement of well-done meat and well-done fish was certainly not the lowest place in catering I'd been. I'd already known the lowest and the dullest. Oyster knives jammed through the webbing of your hand between thumb and forefinger. Steam burns, 23.5-hour days with just a 30-minute nap on the office floor with my head on a pile of folded aprons. Pack-a-day cigarettes, ring molds, braziers, propane torches, roulades in saran wrap, and shelled lobster claws dramatically crowning the 750 martini glasses of ceviche. Misty's catering was organized and calm, and the food was, under the circumstances, totally respectable. She smartly navigated the terrain while hewing to the decidedly unadventurous popular taste. I wouldn't go so far as to say I missed, but I did feel lucky to have already known some of the killer highs of catering, as well as the catering brilliance that had come up in my past 20 years. Because even the most extravagant events that we now catered, at the art museum or the dean's house, were dull and unambitious. There was tremendous wealth in Ann Arbor, but the charity balls and even the private wine dinners we were doing resembled tailgates in a way, with miniature ham on cheddar biscuit hors d'oeuvres and a driveway parked bumper to bumper with the most giant cars that have ever been made on Earth, SUVs manufactured by the Ford Motor Company. I had been exposed to some of the most amazing things that catering presidential inaugurations, the weddings of the daughters of the uber-wealthy, and the ultra-rare concert of Barbra Streisand at Carnegie Hall can yield. Edible gold leaf floating in the champagne flutes, pale green sugar glass blown into the shape of apples under a heat lamp and later filled with apple mousse, and Russian imperial service, in which the entire dining room is surrounded suddenly by 250 waiters, exactly one waiter per guest, each bearing one silver dome plate, and at the signal of the captain, all 250 waiters step forward in stunning synchronicity, lift the domes high into the air to release the steam trapped by the cloche, and place the hot maigret entree perfectly in front of the guest. That kind of magnificence, that expertness of choreography and timing, would have been dismissed as fancy. There was no customer base in Ann Arbor for hand-blown sugar glass. The company's service captain was so disabled by palsy that to watch him ferry a sloshing and rattling silver tray of crystal champagne flutes around to the guests at certain black tie events was excruciating enough and as much of a challenge as he could take on, even if some event organizer had called, improbably, inquiring about the possibility of Russian imperial service. I dressed for work every day in clean check pants and my own clean chef jackets, as I had my whole life, and with some regularity I sharpened my knives, and even those minuscule expressions of professionalism, of respect for the trade, made my new co-workers bristle with what they perceived as excessive self-regard. They wore t-shirts and blue jeans and dirty aprons. It's possible that I now found myself in an unspoken, undeclared, polite, mutual disapproval with both of my new tribes, town and gown. But I will never know for sure because no one would ever say something as straightforward as, "I don't like you." I missed my expressive, volatile New York tribe, not because I like conflict and aggression, but because it is abundantly clear where you stand with the guy who leaps onto the hood of your car and calls you a stupid bitch. When the initial exuberance of landing in Michigan began to wear off, I thought I started to hear all kinds of disapproving tones and implications of distaste in that constant, pallid refrain, "Oh, that's nice," that everyone recited through empty smiles. It was meant to soothe, to go along to get along, to mask the heavy odor of one's true opinions, but it had the opposite effect on me. I stayed awake at night, paranoid, and wondered how I was going to be sure anyone was telling the truth. One night, I slept in my car in my own driveway, paralyzed by something I'll never be able to name. I just pulled into the drive, killed the ignition, reached for the door latch, and suddenly couldn't go through with it. I slumped back in my seat until I woke up the next morning, very early, and finally allowed myself to move onto the porch, get out the key, and go into my little empty apartment. I went crazy for an opinion. I was starved for opinionated opinion, That I had so many and offered them in such abundant mouthfuls made me feel 11 feet tall and garish. Misty found no end of hilarity in this when I reported it to her the following day. "You nut," she laughed. "You slept in your car? Oh, dear." Misty had a taciturnity of impressive measure. I've never met a person who could not talk the way Misty could not talk. My extroverted East Coast demeanor was met for the first 6 months in that catering kitchen from across the prep island with her shy and vaguely grunted, "uh-huh," and her six-word halting sentences. But there was something I had not at first picked up on in Misty, and I was not deterred. She did not spook me. She set up her board each day at one corner of the large prep island, and I looked forward to finding a place across from her, and eventually we started to exchange a few words over the easy pace of the prep day. The conversations, while punctuated by pauses in the walk-in or loading into the van, were evolving from grunts to full sentences, and what she knew about food and cooking was immense. If I mentioned something uncommon I'd cooked or eaten in Turkey, where I'd lived and worked for a period in my early 20s, she knew of it and didn't even hesitate. "Oh, Monty? I've read about that." When I admitted that I loved the pine sap taste of the retsina I'd had in Greece during that same period, she chuckled, and revealing that she knew exactly how it is always served, added, "In those cute copper cups." Through conversations about food, it was possible to gain glimpses of her. Because Misty didn't talk or emote or express anything such as gladness to see me or passionate interest in our conversations or satisfaction with my work, even though we had actually been working together for some 8 months, I had to rely on other signals that we were maybe becoming friends, or at least that she was glad to have a set of capable hands with her in the kitchen. Misty kind of laughed at something I said. "Misty let me make the menu and do all the prep for the edible flower dinner at the Arboretum. Misty offered to give me a tour of downtown Detroit." She did, in fact, offer to give me a tour of downtown Detroit, and one weekend night in the dead of winter, with her wildly talkative husband in tow, we crossed 8 Mile and drove into the city. I was not quite comprehending what we were driving through and could not stop staring at the ruin, mile after mile of burnt-out homes, boarded-up storefronts, all the husks of an abandoned city, inexplicably desolate on a Saturday night. Nestled in every so often, we saw a well-maintained home, the glowing lights of inhabitants, little patches of life eked out of what, especially in the dark, looked like nothing. Even when we got to the hub, it was deserted. All these gorgeous buildings and no one on the street. I was used to Greenwich Village on a weekend night where you have to fight the throngs to even get down the sidewalk. Bill narrated the entire experience from the front seat in a kind of free associative poetry slam manner, rolling his own cigarettes from pouch tobacco and bringing everything he had to the mic, which included his own upbringing in Dearborn, his formidable knowledge of Allah and the Muslim world, a long thesis on automobile versus train travel in Amera, KKK, and Misty deftly downshifted when we hit ice patches and occasionally tapped her husband on the knee and said, "Easy, William." We ate a forgettable dinner in Greektown, had a great drink at the Rhino Club, and enjoyed each other. I think. In my paranoid condition, it seemed more than possible that she was just being hospitable to the unraveling out-of-towner who had just slept in her car in her own driveway, as she might be to, equally, some neighbor's homesick Swedish au pair. But I still wasn't sure, even by the following spring, and when she invited me to her home for a meal, I took it as a declaration and was thrilled. Her collected pack of 6 stray dogs all came racing out and barked their heads off when I pulled up the driveway and stood, pretending not to be afraid, behind my car door. She came out and calmed them all, getting down herself on all fours and kissing and hugging some of them more intimately than I have ever seen her interact with a human person, including her husband, either then or in the 14 years since that I have continued to know her. I hardly recognized her. Their home was a 100-year-old brick house with rough-hewn beams exposed in the basement, surrounded by farmland and part of a land conservancy started by Bill and some friends and neighbors. There was a hand-me-down working John Deere tractor in the driveway, and the spring night air smelled of tilled earth. There were budding fruit trees scattered around the fields, flower beds surrounding the house, and there, sprawling out behind the shed, was an organic garden just 2 mules shy of a farm. She had her own duck prosciutto hanging between the racks in her refrigerator. Shell beans from the year before had dried in their pods in bushels in the garage. At this first dinner, she had brined a capon and then roasted it on a tightly sealed grill by indirect smoky heat. It was possibly the most delicious thing I had eaten all year. We sat on the sun porch, surrounded by all the dogs and cats and houseplants that she devoted herself to, and she poured us some rosé wine, an excellent bandol, another glimpse of herself. Misty, nobody drinks rosé but my mom. Americans think it's déclassé. Uh-huh, she nodded. We had this one in France. We liked it. I walked around her warm, beautiful house, snooping everywhere with the same disoriented fascination as meeting someone's identical twin for the first time. Her pantry shelves had dried anchovies, salt-packed capers, homemade vinegar, and homemade brandied Michigan cherries. Her kitchen cabinets were filled with heavy Le Creuset pots and clay earthenware from Mexico. There was a whole room packed to the rafters with cookbooks. Bill recited half-remembered poetry and filled in the half he couldn't recall with whatever he could make rhyme. Misty drank the wine and spoke in full paragraphs and laughed full-throated laughter, and I could not believe this whole other person before me. I began to feel the stirrings of a remote past, a someone I had been 1,000 lifetimes and fluorescent-lit kitchens ago, and suddenly I found myself digging deep, way deeper than the PVC ring molds and the Silpat mats and the propane brûlée torches of my entire adult life, to find the language to keep up with her. I had to remember the exhale of Bandol Rosé while my mother talked to my father after dinner, not the edible gold leaf and champagne flutes. When Misty put clafoutis on the table for dessert, I had to remember that I knew the taste of the almost muddy, sweet, ripe black fruit of that mulberry bush by the mailbox of my childhood home. Meanwhile, I was starting to have misgivings about going to the writer's workshop. It wasn't that it was too hard for me. Once I got a grasp of the words everyone was using, I too could make my halting way through Derrida and Lacan. I too could understand language as a subjective construction. It had been like a year of Friday crossword puzzles, cautiously undertaken in pencil, but I was getting it. My misgivings were about something else, something less defensive than protecting myself against my own inadequacy. At our final meeting of the semester, I arrived late, having come from work, reeking of roasted bones, onions, molasses. As a group, we had decided to meet for the last time at someone's house instead of at the Grout Lounge, and to make a party of it, and I was not very much in the mood. It was a textbook student pad, scented votives, frame posters, a futon folded up into a couch. And everyone was sitting in a deep hush when I arrived. There were folks on the floor, three on the futon in stockinged feet. Everybody had removed their shoes so as not to damage the Salvation Army throw rug. I quietly push open the door, let myself in, silently wave and signal my apologies. One of the students is reading her work and continues while I settle in. After a year of Monday nights with these guys, I still barely know them. The reader reads aloud with a sing-song up, then down again cadence. My mood shifts from merely reluctant to derisive. It's a tired reading style. I'm sick of it. It attaches more importance to the words than the words themselves, as they've been arranged, could possibly sustain, and it gives poets and poetry a bad name, which is not what I came to graduate school for. I want to forever admire poets. I arrived believing there was meaning and purpose in this work, that this work gives more than it takes, that it helps out. But the longer she goes on in that self-important sing-song way from the candlelit corner, where she is perched on a purple and gold pillow, her black eyeliner thick and greasy, stopping on occasion to explain a few of her references, for those among us who may not know the term chiaroscuro, or who are not familiar with the tropes she is exploring in her prose, the more I fear it's no more a contribution than arranging salmon roulade in a ring mold with tiny dots of pistachio oil garnishing the plate. I feel wholly condescended to when she is explaining her work, but backpedal slightly on my position as soon as I realize that, in truth, a year ago, I did not know the word trope. Before I packed up the Volvo and arrived on that Michigan campus, I would not have been able to use it in a crossword puzzle. Unbelievably, she's reading from pages of pale green rice paper. They remind me of $100 bills, on which she has written by hand. We have computers, of course, in 1997. Her poem is not good, but good-looking and well-dressed. She's missed the point. She should be in bookbinder school. Blindfolded and spun around by her obsession with the handwritten word, the feel of paper, and the smell of ink. In this round of the game, she's pinned the tail far away from the donkey, right into the mantle. She still thinks that writing is about self-expression. I can just picture her, with a favorite calligraphy pen, sitting at her desk in front of the window where a spider plant hangs, a large tablet of expensive hand-wrought paper before her, and a big bowl of milky sweet tea. And there, in the weakening sunlight, she maps out a description of an old man's hands. Her own grandfather's, perhaps. With knuckles like... And ah, the metaphor comes. Like pecans. Knuckles wrinkled and brown, like toasted pecans. She finishes reading and looks up at the room, smug and afraid simultaneously. We remain silent. Some people's eyes are closed, though a couple of people sigh crisply, audibly, as if to say, "You have pierced my soul." I wish we could just read the words out loud and let the stories speak for themselves, but somehow, in just a year, we all know to sing song and to load the thing up with tropes, to spend whole paragraphs describing an old man's hand, and to bow our heads and close our eyes when listening. Aw, fuck, I think to myself, trapped in this girl's living room, in this middle state, in the middle of my crossing, now totally convinced that the route I have chosen is wrong. I will have to survive one more year of this if I want to walk away with the master's degree from the Harvard of the Midwest. To my left, just out of reach, I notice the crudité, raw broccoli florets and those baby carrots washed in formaldehyde, and some bread and cheese. I'm starving. Our leader, who's sitting in the apartment's one comfortable chair, raises his head and announces, "Perfect. Simply perfect." The poet glows brighter than the ginger cranberry candle she is sitting next to. Someone from the futon chimes in. "Truly, that moment with his hand on the back of the kitchen chair, I mean, you really captured that moment perfectly." I go for the cheese cubes and hope for a more generous mood. Elwood hauls his huge football player body up off the floor, where he's been gamely sitting, and comes over to the cheese platter. Conspiratorially, he says, "I gotta go. I've got dandruff." And my mood instantly lifts to discover someone else here who's struggling with this shit. In the fall, I went to another, much larger dinner at Misty's house, and I met lots of her friends. She had me cut down the last of the rhubarb from the garden and grill the sardines outside by the light of car headlights, while Bill smoked pot and filled the bird feeders, and I was proud and honored to be put to use. I would have walked into the cold stream barefoot if she'd asked me. I had sharp, transportive flashes to every party my parents had ever thrown. Misty was inside, not quite 10 years my senior, but just old enough to not be exactly my peer, with a kitchen towel draped over her shoulder and in a bib apron, drinking a mojito with mint from her garden as she arranged cauliflower and zucchini and onions into earthenware baking dishes. All of their friends, philosophy of religion professors, hairdressers, Ford engineers, surrounded her to watch and chat or wandered in the garden or stood by the charcoal fire where I was grilling, and their voices and laughter drifted out over the Michigan landscape. At work, we were cooking the required filet mignon with horseradish cream and super fudge chunk brownies, but at her home, where I had become like one of her stray dogs picked up on a back road, she cooked all the dark and oily fishes like bluefish and mackerel and sardines. She served pork shoulder, pork shank, lamb tongue, lamb legs, and lamb sausages. She made true duck confit. When she emptied the garden and started the enormous labor of pickling, canning, and smoking, enough to fill a room in the cellar with hundreds of ball jars, dated in her handwriting with Sharpie marker, I sometimes helped. I was in the thesis stretch of my degree, so I had fewer classes and more time. We made cordials, cornichons with the tiny yellow blossoms sometimes still attached, and Concord grape juice, except for the year that Michigan Concord grapes were wiped out from Pontiac to Petoskey. We grilled thickly sliced bread and ate it right there, in the moment, warm and charred. Nothing like that air-blasted baguette that sat out on rolling racks under the fluorescent lighting at work. And we made, by hand and not in a robo-coup, toppings from olives or Swiss chard or beans. We shucked many varieties, yellow steubens and tongues of fire and flageolet, of fresh shell beans from her huge garden. In the winter, we hauled what she hadn't had time to shuck out of the shed, these last beans still in their pods, though drier, and merely cooked them longer. She combined meat and fish in the same dish. She deep-fried as regularly and with as little hesitation as you or I might brew coffee. The cheeses she ate at home sat out unwrapped on the counter and stank and oozed, and always, always, she offered a well-made, well-researched cocktail. I had met a girl at work, a big, butch Michigander who had never once lived out of state, and I was loving her so much that it made the weirdness of Michigan and the uncertainty of my whole enterprise there suddenly bearable and even sometimes a total blast. I also had made the crucial, successful move to make some friends outside of the English department, and there were people in the School of Environmental Sciences and Statistics, like my friend David, for example, who were not anguished at all, whatsoever, and who played excellent pool, drank bourbon, and built large fires outside as a pastime. With him, I had more fun with language than I was ever going to have in that building with the oil portraits. "You're such a tree hugger," I taunted, when he went on and on about the ozone layer and renewable resources. "Only the cute ones," he grinned. In the university program where I was supposed to be emancipating myself from the kitchen, preparing myself to go back to New York, having at least answered the question of my own potential, the novelty and thrill had thoroughly worn off. I could not find the fun or the urgency in the eventless and physically idle academic life. It was so lethargic and impractical and luxurious. I adored reading and writing and having my brain crushed, but those soft, ghostly people lounging around the lounge in agony over their texts, endlessly theorizing over experiences they would never have, made me ache to get out of the leather chairs, to put my shoes and socks back on, and get back into the kitchen, which I increasingly found practical and satisfying. The work may not have held much meaning and purpose, but I was gunning the motor of my car to get off campus and get to it each day. To tackle a prep list at 8 a.m. and have it knocked out by 4 p.m., black Sharpie line crossing out each item on the to-do list, 6 quarts aioli, brown brisket, butcher salmon, toast walnuts, felt so manageable and tactile and useful. I could wake up and tackle that in a way that I would never be able to wake up and take a crack at certain literary pursuits, like, for example, illuminating the fog surrounding the human condition. This is not to suggest that I accepted this understanding about myself gladly, with just a sneering dismissal of the pursuit in the first place, human condition. It's a blow to have to admit to yourself that you are not quite cut out for something that matters so much to you. More than a blow, it's a knockout. I had to lie down on the floor of my apartment for a very long time, letting that one sink in. Did I have something more to offer? Any other talent than a strong work ethic? Did I have something in me other than dishwasher? As it turns out, I did not. To stand at the prep table with other cooks who were just doing mundane things like fixing the car over the weekend, cleaning the house, and shuttling their kids to doctor's appointments felt newly satisfying and meaningful enough. I liked these people and their lives, but more to the point, I came to understand that I liked people and life. After sitting around for too long in those leather chairs, I welcomed the intense pressure of getting a dinner for 200 plated quickly, and came to see that there was a rush and a method in that that I hadn't quite known to what extent I liked and needed in my life. And I will admit, spending that chilly hour cleaning out a cluttered walk-in and putting impeccable order to it is still, 30 years later, my favorite part of kitchen life. I bring my mother's compulsion for concrete order with me wherever I go. My resolve to start a new kitchen-free life was further weakening in the direct warmth of Missy's home style of cooking, her bumpy, misshapen tomatoes ripening on the back steps, her cabbages shredded and broken down with salt and vinegar, her hunks of pork swimming in smoky, deep, earthy juices. Unwittingly, she was untethering me from my 10-pound knife kit, propane torches, and ring molds, and showing me that what I had been doing these past 20 years, and what I had come to think of as cooking, was just the impressive 14-ring string of a 12-year-old exhaling her first lungfuls of a Marlboro. Nothing more than the tricks of the trade. She was waking me, in her nearly monosyllabic way, out of a dark and decades-long amnesia. But then, without telling me, and worse, without taking me, Misty worked her last day at the catering company and went across town to pursue an opportunity to open a restaurant. Misty, without letting on in the slightest, was in the early stages of opening a restaurant across town with her brother as co-chef, and because she would never behave in such poor form as to poach cooks from the catering company, she did not offer jobs to anyone there. She just left. Her spot across from me at the prep island remained empty as we continued to cook the old familiar menus on autopilot. We watched as the owner apprehensively auditioned new chefs. One chef came, and then another, and one more still, and I stuck it out at the catering company for a few more months. The last chef I worked for introduced his signature dish in the first week or two, a pounded veal breast with a blueberry frangelico sauce topped with prosciutto, parmesan, and pine nuts. And I clocked out on that dish and ran to Misty. I begged her for a job. Decent, timid catering food was one thing, but blueberry frangelico sauce? They were planning a pantropical place, which allowed her to cook dishes from countries around the equator. I could feel and see her excitement and fresh energy, not only to be in a new place after 8 years in the old one, with permission from the owners to really open up, but also to get her hands on new ingredients and to read incessantly about unfamiliar dishes and cultures. The giant pile of books on her desk was heavily marked with yellow sticky memo tabs. The whole experience gave her demeanor a brightness that made the stained V-neck t-shirts that she still wore seem almost clean. Within weeks, she was happily exhausted rather than hopelessly worn down. She was almost talkative. For the first time, I had picadillo, the slightly sweet ground meat hash popular in Spanish and Latin countries, and chimichurri, the green Argentinian sauce with chopped herbs, and asafoetida, the pungent, sulfuric Indian flavoring. Reluctantly, I tried Malibu coconut rum in cocktails, and they worked. She made pho, lemongrass ice cream, macadamia nut tartlets with lime curds, coconut creams, and passion fruit syrups. It was legitimate and well-prepared and delicious. We tested dishes over and over until we got them right, and they seemed, in spite of their Vietnamese origins, not out of place there on State Street across from the university. She found a local tortilla maker in Detroit, and she persuaded the famous Michigan store Zingerman's to make chipotle challah for her Rock Shrimp Club sandwich. She found fresh kefir lime leaves. She went through cases of nuoc mam and enough galangal to fill a boat at the Bangkok floating market. I saw fresh turmeric for the first time in her new kitchen, and so learned, a bit late in my cooking life, I thought, for someone who thought for sure she knew everything, the difference between a root and a rhizome. Misty was able to distinguish between an Indonesian, a Chinese, a Vietnamese, and a Thai ground shrimp paste. It was the first time I heard a chef say, "I don't know, let me look it up." It was the first time I saw a chef solicit the opinion or experience of her staff. She was willing, always, to learn from any source. If the dishwasher's mother had made pozole for 20 years at every family reunion, Misty would ask him about it, if not to learn something that she didn't already know, at least to benchmark her own experience against it. It was a good kitchen. She ran it well. It was the first time I saw a chef ask relevant questions of job seekers at their interviews. "How long is your commute?" "Your fiancé lives in Chicago." "This is your third DUI?" "Between jail and TGI Fridays, you worked salads at Bombay Bicycle Lounge for how long?" She knew well that the cooking end of things would be apparent in these applicants as soon as they entered the kitchen, and that it was a waste of interview time to ask them about their kitchen skills, which everybody lies about anyway. She was keen to discover if the rest of the package existed, the part where you need your crew to be somewhat sane, logical, and reliable. I learned from Misty that when a cook tells you that his girlfriend is moving to LA to break into movies, you had better start preparing for the departure of the boyfriend as well. When I had my final reading for my thesis, she knew well, and I knew that she knew, that my own move back to New York was not far behind. "And the lovebird, is she going too?" she asked, referring to my Michigan girlfriend. "So it appears," I said. "She's packing her boxes. But I'm going to have to teach her how to drive faster and to give people the finger, or she'll be eaten alive." Misty chuckled. "Well, I guess I'm going to have to come visit." Once during that miserable school year with our mother in Vermont, my seventh grade class took a school trip to New York City and visited the famous sculptor Klaus Oldenburg's studio in Soho. When we entered, there was a large white horizontal plank in the center of the room, and he had put a peephole in the center, exactly like the fisheye peephole in every New York City apartment door. When you bent over and peered through it, you saw the back of your own head where you would have expected to have seen your own feet. It was so disorienting that it actually took several moments for you to understand what you were seeing. Some people took a long time figuring out what they were looking at. It's not as assured and graceful as you might think to recognize the back of your own head when you see it, especially when it is not where you expect to find it. I had been staring right at Misty across that prep table and didn't even recognize her for what she would come to be. It took me a long time to figure out what this woman in a dirty t-shirt grilling chicken breasts was teaching me, or even to admit that I had learned something from her. One does not fend entirely for herself starting at puberty, and then gladly and easily turn around and credit just anyone who happens to come along later in life with having helped out. These kinds of admissions are careful, gradual, delayed. To call Misty my mentor isn't accurate. I suspect it makes us both kind of uncomfortable, the implied intimacy of it for her and the fealty of it for me. And yet, if you squint with one eye and look through that peephole, that is what she, for a certain important period, became. Chapter 8. I was not looking to open a restaurant. That was never on my mind. I was just dashing out to park the car one spring morning when I ran into my neighbor, Eric, a guy I knew only peripherally from years of living on the same block. I didn't even know his last name, but we often saw each other during that hectic morning ritual of alternate side parking that New Yorkers, or at least East Villagers, seem to barely accomplish in time to beat the meter maid. It's a twice-a-week early morning ritual, Mondays and Thursdays, or Tuesdays and Fridays, depending on which side of the street you're on, in which everyone on the block with a car comes rushing out of their building to move their machines, still wearing their pajamas and with pillow creases still marking their faces. Eric was sitting on the stoop in front of a long-shuttered restaurant space mid-block, and as I zoomed by in my sweatpants and hastily slipped on clogs, we waved. He said, "You still cooking?" I was, technically. I had taken an interim chef job at one of those huge Westside Highway catering companies where I had formerly been a freelancer, while they performed a thorough talent search to find their real next chef. I was just a 3-month placeholder during the dead season, which is why I felt fine taking the job. I reasoned that it was a moderate way for me to make some money while I continued to write and to resolve my last lingering uncertainties about my place in a kitchen. "I am, sort of," I said. "Want to take a look at this space?" I was off that day, with big plans to sit on my couch procrastinating the writing of my novel in progress. "Sure, I'll take a look. Why not?" There was a faded yellow typewritten letter in the window from the former tenant, a French guy who had run a bistro that thrived for a brief but bright couple of years, advising customers that the restaurant would just be closing for a 2-week vacation and renovation. "They look forward to seeing you soon. Bonne vacances!" 2 weeks had turned into 2 years, and I could see, from the second we stepped inside, that there had been no vacation planned at all. "Bankruptcy," Eric said. It looked like the restaurant had desperately done business right up until 12:01 a.m. when the city marshal came and padlocked the place, leaving the coolers full of lamb shanks, dairy, and creme brulees. There were racks of dirty dishes sitting outside the machine, which sat ajar, as if the dishwasher had just run downstairs for a few more clean towels and a gallon of pink liquid before running his next load. The pot sink was packed with dirty sauté pans. The pastry station had black, shriveled pastry in the coolers, and the espresso machine had hard, spent pucks of powder fossilized into the ports. Next to the machine sat a stainless steel pitcher with long spoons in it, as if a cafe macchiato was in the works just as the city's assessor walked in the door with his huge ring of keys. There were cigarette butts in the ashtray, as if the early waiter had already sat down and begun his paperwork and tip sorting at the end of his shift. Eric, who owned a couple of units upstairs in the co-op and who was now putting some effort into sorting out the mess of the abandoned storefront, showed me around the restaurant as I held my t-shirt pressed over my nose and mouth. The place was putrid. The floors grabbed the soles of my shoes with every step. So much rat shit had melted in the summer heat and commingled with the rat urine over the 2 years that the space had sat there idle that it was like walking on old glue traps. I had to run outside for gulps of fresh air after several minutes in the restaurant. The electricity, oddly, had not been cut off, but the light bulbs had died, and most egregiously, the Freon had run out in coolers that still had running fans. When I opened a door on the sauté station reach-in refrigerator, I was hit by a blast of fetid warm air coming from decomposed lamb shanks and chicken carcasses. There were legions of living cockroaches. The basement was very dark. Only one tube of a fluorescent flickered overhead. It was impossible not to jump out of your skin with the creeps with every brush of your own hair on your own neck. In the walk-in, by the dim light of a weak flashlight, I stupidly opened a full case of apples, only to have a gray, sooty cloud of spores, like a swarm of gnats, fly up into my nostrils and eyelashes. 25 pounds of apples had rotted away to black dust. And yet, even with the cockroaches crawling over bread baskets and sticky bottles of Pernod, I could see that the place had immense charm. There was an antique zinc bar with just 4 seats that had been salvaged from a bistro in France and shipped over. There were gorgeous antique mirrors everywhere, making the tiny space seem bigger than it was, and an old wooden banquette and wrought iron table bases. The floor, under all that sticky rat excreta, was laid with the exact same tiny hexagonal tiles that had been on the floor of a creperie in Brittany, where I had worked for a brief period in my early 20s. Even when gulping the comparatively fresh New York City air once back on the sidewalk, thinking I might have been poisoned in some way, I knew the space was exactly me. There were 10 sturdy burners, just 2 ovens, and fewer than 30 seats. I could cook by hand, from stove to table, never let a propane brulee torch near a piece of food, and if it came down to it, I could just reach over the pass and deliver the food myself. I knew exactly what and how to cook in that kind of space. I knew exactly what kind of fork we should have. I knew right away how the menu should read and how it would look handwritten. And I knew immediately, even, what to call it. "Any interest?" Eric asked. A thin blue line of electricity was running through my body. "Maybe," I bluffed. I had no idea how to open a restaurant. I had that work ethic and that nearly strange mania for cleaning and organizing kitchens to forever recreate my own mother's. And I had just spent a few good long years understanding my relationship to kitchen work itself and could, with a certain calmness, claim to have put the question to bed. The greener pastures I had been straining my neck to gaze at all those years were not, predictably, as sweet and filled with clover as I had always imagined. But in all the most pertinent ways, I had nothing. For starters, I had never been the chef of a restaurant. I had never even been the sous chef of a restaurant. I had never cut a check for more than $1,000 or balanced a checkbook that ever had more in it than $1,015. All I knew about a walk-in refrigerator was how to tidy it up, and the most I knew about an oven was how to turn it on and roast a brine turkey in it. The only lawyer I'd ever retained was the one who'd bailed me out of my grand larceny charges as a 17-year-old. To imagine that a newly jogged memory about the few dishes and food experiences I had managed to collect at my mother's apron strings would be enough to sustain a restaurant would be naive. And to open a restaurant with nothing more than an idea for a menu, a clean kitchen, and an apt name would have been certain failure. As we parted on the sidewalk, I said to Eric with a distinct doubtfulness, "I'll think about it. Let's talk again later." But once back in my apartment, I felt very nearly combustible with something I could not tamp down with any blanket of reason or logic I threw in front of it. I doodled menus, pulled some plates down from my own stack and set a mock table. I opened the windows to the new spring weather and cranked the stereo with songs I fantasized would bust out of the speakers at my new restaurant. To try and disrupt this electric hum of rightness that had taken hold in my gut and was now spreading through my being, I recited at length my lack of restaurant experience. I punctuated every thought with that famous statistic that 80% of new businesses go under in the first year. I pointed out to myself that I had never fired anyone, and noted that I certainly had never been involved in the even more complex parts of bosshood that crop up in between the beginning and the end of an employee's tenure, like issuing a W-2, understanding FICA taxes, and articulating a sexual harassment policy. In spite of my efforts to be rational, the birds and the sunshine were in concert outside, as if egging me on, And while I told myself over and over that I couldn't possibly open a restaurant in New York City, the most critical and sophisticated place on earth, where I would be eaten alive by some restaurant reviewer within the first 15 minutes of unlocking the doors, I nonetheless merrily pulled out all of my wooden salad bowls and wooden cutting boards and wondered if it would be a health code violation to use them in my restaurant instead of the heavy white plastic ones. As I reminded myself of my total lack of credentials, not to mention my total lack of one thin dime, let alone the 50 large I would need to put towards such a venture to play serious, I simultaneously fantasized ripping out the fluorescents and replacing them with incandescents. While anyone who actually knew what they were doing would have come right home and crunched some numbers involving square footage, check average, and an ROI for her backers, I sprawled on the couch in my bare feet, staring into the middle distance, and wondered how I might serve walnuts from the Perigord and a small perfect tangerine so that the restaurant patrons could also sit at their table after the meal and squeeze the citrus peel into the candle flame to make fragrant blue and yellow sparks as I had done on my mother's lap as a child. By dusk that same evening, I called Eric and said, "I'd like to take another closer look."